You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence is broadcasted to you from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty was never ceded, and I pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. And also to say, let's bring back First Nations customary law, as today we're going to be talking about saving wildlife. And, well, one of the best ways to do that is to bring back the kind of cultural practices that were here before colonization. Let's go to the show sing and then we'll get into it.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush. The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
It's a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, a show about how we live in the cities and suburbs and the ideologies behind them. Fridays every fortnight at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR 855 AM.
From rubbish tip to you.
And out of the rubbish tip is me, your host Amy, your serial pest. And I am bringing you today an interview I had with Wildlife Victoria on the road toll of native wildlife here in Victoria. So we're going to go straight into that interview that I recorded. But I would also just like to throw in the kill your lawn, kick your fence sort of thinking here about how communities are what can really save wildlife. And you getting involved, whether it's a friends of group, as in friends of X Park, friends of the river group kind of thing, or, you know, starting a local community garden. They seem small and apolitical, but they are very powerful in organizing and protecting nature, but also in meeting other human beings in this time where we are all atomized and we are taught to hate the other, even though we are all oppressed by a very few small people, percentage of people. So let's go to that interview. But think about wildlife and its importance. Think about the ecological benefit. We'll talk a bit more about that during the interview. But yeah, let's go to that interview.
So my name is Alicia Hall. I work in the external relations team at Wildlife Victoria. And Wildlife Victoria is a charity organisation. It was started in Victoria all the way back in 1989. And our key operation is an emergency response service for native wildlife. So that involves a room full of people that can take a call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from members of the public if they encounter a sick, injured or orphaned native animal. And what we can do is provide advice. So everyone on our emergency response service team is highly trained and has immense experience in the sector, and can also deploy a volunteer if need be. So we have about 1,300 registered and trained volunteers in Victoria who would go out and respond to those incidences and help members of the public handle them.
That's amazing. I think I came across one of these volunteers once when I was in the Otways, and I came across a kangaroo corpse on the road, but it looked really fresh. And I just sort of pulled over, and this wonderful person also pulled over from who was like and checked the pouch and for like a Joey or a pinky. And unfortunately there was a pinky and they couldn't do anything about that. I was just thinking about that. But they educated me and they were very just an amazing human being. I just thought this was just an amazing thing to be doing as a volunteer. The pinky thing, could you maybe explain to our guests what a pinky is?
Yeah, that's I suppose a developmental stage for our marsupials, so our pouch animals here in Australia. So you think of your kangaroos, your wombats, also possums, koalas are also an example. I just have to say that the people that do this kind of work, and I say work because they do it for free, but it is work, are absolutely incredible. And I think it's really on the back of what they do that we're able to maintain and do the work that we do and to help native wildlife, because there are a lot of things that are impacting them. And nobody else is doing it. So they are absolutely incredible and giving up their time and also their money, because it's driving out to a location that might be for a pouch check for a kangaroo that has a joey, and the pinky is the smallest stage of development. So they're still in the pouch.
And they can't be saved if I understand correctly.
Yeah, there's a point where they become, we kind of say that from a velvet stage where they have that kind of soft downy fur, that they are able to live outside the pouch, but there is that period where that they're relying on mum.
Yeah.
And without her, they can't survive. So sadly, that is often an outcome. And hit by vehicle cases are really prevalent in Victoria. We're definitely seeing that. Through our emergency response service, it's the most called in report that we receive. So it's definitely a really big issue.
Let's continue with talking about road incidents and animals. So obviously we live in a society that is a car society. Most people use cars to get around. There's also a lot of freight with massive trucks. And so one of the problems that your organization is dealing with is when native wildlife get hit by vehicles. Do you have any stats or any like information to give us like a big picture of what the toll is on native wildlife when it comes to road accidents? And is road accident the right thing to say? Sorry, what would you say?
I guess it is. It is a road accident. I think we kind of call it. We call it the wildlife road toll. A road strike involving a native animal. And there was a study a few years ago which found, I think across Australia, it was on average about 10 million native animals were being hit on the roads per year. What we're seeing at Wildlife Victoria, and we can only use the data that we have called in to us, there's been an average increase over the past 4 years of around 30%. And anecdotally speaking, you're kind of seeing it in your peri-urban areas, so where there is a lot of change in the landscape or the development of land. So new roads going through habitat and pushing wildlife closer to human populations. And that seems to be, they might be fenced in or unable to make their way out of that area. And I suppose the other thing to consider is it's their home. So, we had an incident last year in the Whittlesea municipality where they just put in a new road that basically dissected a kangaroo mob's land. So you had the mob split across two paddocks on either side of this brand new road. And they had to cross to reach resources and to reach each other. And And that's kind of something we're seeing replicated across the state, is these incidences that keep happening a lot due to development.
And I think I work in horticulture as a gardener, and I've worked a lot in areas where there are new sort of housing being built by private property developers. And yeah, I'm actually seeing, it's interesting because there was one where I started, it was along Donnybrook Road in a town called Mickleham. And just what you described was happening, because what was happening was there, Donnybrook Road was running east to west through the town, but the town was gradually having more and more traffic come through, but also new roads being built. And there were mobs that I could see living in the area, mobs of kangaroo. And then the big trucks coming through, building the roads and the cars. And because a lot of my garden sites were on the sides of roads, I was actually coming into contact with a lot of dead kangaroos. And then over about a year, I started to just not see the mobs around anymore. And I assume that might also be because they've migrated, but I also saw a lot of roos being killed. So I guess one of the things I would ask is, has Wildlife Victoria been advising or making recommendations to these sort of new housing projects and or just new developments?
Probably not directly.
Yeah.
We are, again, as I said, a charity. Our main focus is on responding to those sick, injured and orphaned wildlife. We definitely do advocacy work, and one of our key focuses is wildlife being hit by vehicles, because it is such a large issue. And we have started to engage with councils and state departments on what could be done. In 2023, we initiated a pilot project called the Wildlife Road Toll Reduction Project, and that initial stage was really just to kind of get an understanding of what's happening out there. So what are, we can see what the problem is, we can see the outcome, what's causing it, what's being done in different parts of the state and the world, what are those mitigation strategies that seem to have an impact, what are the challenges for those councils, because councils are responsible for local roads and they do a lot of the precinct structure plans, which are those long-term plans for development, sit within council. What are the things that are challenging for them? Like, how can we help them to actually make change that reduces impact?
And the other part, I guess, that so where can listeners find that road toll project that Wildlife Victoria is doing, so they can start to see the stats and tolls themselves?
Yeah, there's some information up on our website. So it's wildlifevictoria.org.au. And if you just head into the advocacy section on our website, there's some information there. And I suppose that project is, it's focused on councils because they have one of the biggest roles to play in actually introducing and implementing change. And so we're trying to work really closely with them. But we know that nothing gets done without grassroots activism from people in communities, talking to their local, their state, their federal members, representatives, to say, hey, this is an issue for me. Like, I'm seeing this every day and it's impacting me. So what are you doing? I couldn't encourage that more to listeners, to say, you know, if you're wondering what you can do, we're about to hit a federal election, reach out to your federal member, make wildlife an election issue, make the environment an election issue.
Wildlife Victoria is a non-profit emergency response service committed to assisting wildlife in need across Victoria. Our trained and dedicated volunteers rescue and rehabilitate sick, injured and orphaned animals so they can be released back to their native habitat. If you see wildlife that may need our help, please contact us on 8400 7300. To donate or register to become a volunteer, hop onto our website at wildlifevictoria.org.au.
A 3CR supporter.
Freedom of Species is a show about animals, for animals, listened to by humans. Tune in Sundays, 1 p.m.
Born to be wild. Born to be wild.
And you're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM or on the Community Radio Plus app or at 3cr.org.au. We are in the middle of an interview I did with Alicia from Wildlife Victoria. Sorry, stumbling over my words. And I would just like to add on voting that there is a chance of a hung parliament in this next federal election. And with these new, with the Labor's campaigning for social obedience, sorry, I mean social cohesion. Social obedience? What? There's not, Yeah, with their social obedience laws, they're going to make it. We're seeing that there's actually some laws in the Victorian government around the forestry. I think it was that they're going to stop people bringing glue and chains and rope so they can't attach themselves to machinery where they're doing forest logging, which obviously affects native wildlife. So it's really important that we continue to build these grassroots communities and to get involved because even in a hung parliament, if you remember back to the Rudd-Gillard years, particularly the Gillard years, and it would probably be a different political spectrum under the next, if there is a hung parliament after the next federal election, but there was a lot of compromise and in the policies that were getting put through. So it's really the people power that is going to hold power to account or even create a meaningful shift in power. All right, let's get back into the Wildlife Victoria interview. So I guess kangaroos are one of the animals that people tend to think, oh, they're fine. They're in large numbers en masse. But from my perspective, they're being displaced from habitat and coming into lots of contact with road incidents. But also, I always see things like they're planning to do a col over here or they're a kangaroo col over there. What's going on with kangaroo populations in Victoria? What's the story?
Yeah, it's a really good question about what actually is happening with populations because there's... The only surveying that I know of is done by the Arthur Riley Institute for the purpose of providing that data to the government for programs that are designed to kill kangaroos. So they conduct these surveys, I think, on a biannual basis, and they use that to extrapolate what they think is the wider populations. Obviously, they can't count every kangaroo. It would be impossible to count every kangaroo in the state in one kind of go. So they'll do it along aerial transects across Victoria and extrapolate that out. So if they see 50 along that line, they say, well, there's probably another 50 for another however far. So that's how they base their quotas. And what they predict to be the population of kangaroos. Most commonly, we've got eastern greys in Victoria, though there are western greys and reds as well, but predominantly it's eastern greys. And then what happens with that data, in Victoria we have the Kangaroo Harvesting Program, which is a government-led and overseen program which sanctions the commercial killing of our kangaroos. So that started in about, I think they did a trial in 2018 and it was introduced officially in 2020. And basically under that program, landowners can arrange for a commercial shooter to attend their property and to kill kangaroos that are living there.
So there's no like environmental impact assessment with that kind of arrangement?
The assessment is really done through the application that they make to the department.
Okay.
So it's they would say that there's a reason that they need these kangaroos removed. Yeah. So, for example, if you're on some farmland and you feel that it's impacting your farm, you might say, well, there's a really large mob here. The land can't accommodate them. I want them gone. And it can also take place on public land. The government sets it as the quotas as 10% of the estimated population of kangaroos. And say, for example, this year, the kangaroo harvesting program quota is at around 106,000 kangaroos are allowed to be killed across Victoria.
Right. That's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah.
And is that 10% of so that 106,000, that's 10% of the overall population that they think is there, or?
It's meant to be, but there's also another part. So running concurrently to the kangaroo harvesting program is the authority to control wildlife permit system. So this has been around for even longer than the kangaroo harvesting program. It's permits provided by the government so people can cull kangaroos for whatever purpose that they have come forward for. Sometimes the government will say there's a non-lethal method of control. Predominantly, it does sound like it's more lethal methods are used. And so I haven't seen the numbers for 2024, but in 2023, there were 73,000 kangaroos lethally controlled. So if you look at if you've got 100,000 in the kangaroo harvesting program, up to 100,000 in the ATCW program, there's a lot of kangaroos that are being killed.
So the kangaroos are really taking quite the brunt of a lot of traffic incidents and also the culling. And so what you're saying is that there isn't really a statewide assessment of how, just viewing how populations are going and the general health of kangaroo populations. Is that not happening, or?
I think if it was, it would be happening through government.
Okay.
So there's definitely programs that they would have to see what's happening on a wider sense of populations. And there would be incidences that impact and they'd review. So for example, fires that we're seeing at the moment, it's the government's role to look at what's happening with our species and to see where they can provide support. Unfortunately, a lot of the approach is to not interfere, even when there's things where you think that maybe from a welfare perspective, you should be providing things like supplementary feed or supplementary water.
Okay. Yeah.
They will there's a lot more of a focus on threatened species.
Of course. Yeah. And that's probably where a lot of citizen science is as well. People counting, you know, that rare species of bird in their area. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's, speaking of Mickleham, the area you spoke about earlier, we've been working with the Hume City Council on the wildlife road toll reduction project, and that's one of the key areas they've kind of identified as an issue.
And that would intersect with Vic Roads as well, wouldn't it? Because Donnybrook Road is managed by Vic Roads.
Yes, and there's a lot of complexity in this project because of how many stakeholders are involved. So you have people that... The councils are looking at local roads. The council can dispatch waste teams to collect deceased animals on local roads. But Vic Roads is responsible for any state-owned freeways, roads and so forth. So there's gaps in who's responding and the communication that happens between orgs.
Yeah.
Which can make it quite hard. But... kangaroos do seem to be, they are the most reported species that we receive calls regarding. Hit by vehicles is the most common cause type that we receive. And there is a couple of reasons, I think. And then it is around development, and we're moving into more areas of land that were mob land, and we're taking that space over, and that's where you're getting more people reporting that they're seeing more kangaroos, that they're just more commonly going to be in those urban and peri-urban areas because that used to be their home. And, you know, it's something that I think people will have to become more accustomed to. And if you're moving into these areas, that education piece around,
yeah,
you will see native wildlife, and aren't we lucky to live alongside native wildlife?
Yeah.
And would you want to be in a world where we didn't get to have that, or we didn't get to see that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just thinking as well, like, it's such a... So this show is going to be covering a lot of urban planning type stuff, and it'll be interesting to listen to what people at the forefront of more innovative, progressive urban planning have to say on this. But and we will, and this is going to link to something we're going to talk about later, but it's much easier to, in your backyard, care for possums and birds than it is for a kangaroo because of how kangaroos travel across space and land, and that... They're largely a grass field dependent. I'm pretty sure that's what their main source of food is grasslands.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And
native vegetation. Yeah.
And a lot of people don't probably realize that a lot of those paddocks, those huge swaths of paddocks, in the like agricultural areas, are filled with non-indigenous invasive grasses that they actually can't eat.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I really, I attended a conference last year, which was around road toll just all across the world. And there were some amazing speakers who were talking about solutions that were working or that they were trying to establish. But there was an ecologist who spoke and talked about how when you look at where vegetation is located in Victoria, it's by roadsides quite frequently, and you can see this if you zoom out on a map. It's interesting that you said it with the work you were doing in Donnybrook, is that it is alongside the roads, and then you see the farmlands that occupy great open spaces, which might be fine for them to populate at some periods of time, but they're attracted to roads because of resources.
Yep.
There's food, there's shade, so they're going to spend time there, and that's where the increased risk is.
Yeah, so perhaps even rethinking pastures. It's probably a very controversial one, but well, you know, I always feel bad for sheep when I drive past those pastures in the heat of summer and there's no trees in the field. Like, you know,
I always think the same thing.
Traditionally, in a lot of European cultures, they had oak trees in those fields because over winter, the acorns that drop over autumn would full of fat, and they would fatten up sheep and help them get through the winter. But they're also an amazing shade cover tree. But I just never see much shade provided for just even the foreign species. And I just sort of like, I always wonder if there's ways that we could change pastures in a way, but I would be upsetting farmers, and that's probably a whole other topic. But
I'm assuming there's a reason that they don't want trees in the middle of paddocks. But I also, from a I've always been an animal lover, and I've always thought that I've always on hot days, how are they surviving? They've got, you know, one tree by a fence line, and there's a huge hurdle. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is there. trees.
Yeah. So we might, unless, is there anything that you would like to just say, because this won't be our first sort of interview segment that I might play, and then I might do another segment talking about other wildlife. So is there anything people can do? You were talking about lobbying politicians. Is there anything people can do now to help look out for and protect kangaroo populations?
Yeah, I think that advocacy piece is a big one. Dispelling myths around kangaroos. There's a lot of misconception that they're a pest species. They often get called that.
Yeah.
They're not a pest species. They're a native species. They've lived here for millions of land. They've lived here for millions of years, and play a really important and integral role in our ecosystem. They promote the regeneration of native plants. They're a natural controller of vegetation. They're a vital food source for apex predators. I'm not an ecologist, so I can't speak too much to the ecosystem impact, but it's evident that if we remove a species from our ecosystem, there's going to be long-term impact. So we've seen that with dingoes and the impact that culling on dingoes has had. And if people are sort of suggesting that kangaroos are in like proportions, it's if there's anything in that, it's around removal of their apex predator.
Yes, that would be a very good point to consider. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me, Alicia. It's been really great learning about this. Thank you.
Can I do one plug? I'll just do a plug for the number.
Yeah.
Have to say to listeners, save the Wildlife Victoria Emergency Response Service number in your phone.
Yep.
It's 03-8400-7300. It's 24/7. If you see any sick, injured, orphan native animals, do give us a call and we can provide that advice. And we are a charity, so if you're in the position to help us, just head to our website and make a donation and make sure we can continue to do the vital work that we're doing.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Have you heard of long COVID? If you or someone you know have had COVID-19, you may still experience symptoms weeks or months later. There are many symptoms of long COVID, but the most frequent are extreme tiredness, shortness of breath, and muscle aches and joint pains. Anyone can experience long COVID, including children. You can find information in your language on the Health Translations website, healthtranslations.vic.gov.au. Just type long COVID as a keyword.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
And welcome back to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR Community Radio. You were just listening to an interview I did with Alicia from Wildlife Victoria. That's part one. There is a part two coming next week. Listeners may remember from a couple of episodes ago that I had Rachel from the APR Collective. Today, I have another APR Collective person, which is Anna. Anna, can I get you to say hello?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me, Amy.
My pleasure. And let's hear a little bit about who you are.
Oh, yes, of course. Thank you. So I'm Mexican mestiza. Mm-hmm. I've been in NAM for the last 8 years, almost nine. So this is where I call home now. But I'm sort of a geoanthropologist.
Yeah.
I have a background in cultural anthropology and then somehow ended in the field of geography, urban planning and architecture. Mm-hmm. So I've been working in Melbourne in the sphere of water, particularly.
Yeah. With Monash?
With Monash, yeah. And I'm going to start another fellowship at La Trove, which is very exciting.
Amazing. And mestiza, if I'm correct, means sort of mixed indigenous and Spanish heritage?
Yes. Well, yep. In my case, it's a bit of a mix. So I'm mostly Indigenous, yep. But then I have, from my mother's side, I have another mix of Balkans and German sort of ancestry.
Yeah. Who's the APR Collective?
APR Collective. So it's APR Collective for Friends, but the full name is the Alliance for Praxis Research.
Yep.
It's a collective formed by young sort of academics and scholars. Most of us have done or just finished our PhDs in different universities.
Mm-hmm.
And it started as around four or five years ago,
mm-hmm.
amidst the, you know, the COVID sort of lockdown situations. We felt like we had a very isolated life, you know, doing a PhD in different universities through COVID, which was already hard enough.
Mm.
So we had a coffee one day and we just decided that we wanted to do something to sort of do what we couldn't do inside the institution. But also all of us have this immense energy to produce and create things that are outside of a normal scope of the university.
Yeah, and this show is about breaking down our atomized lives that are built into our society. So it's interesting to think that it's not even just how we live in the cities and suburbs, but even in academia that happens. Yeah.
Exactly. So we wanted to break a little bit the silos of unis. We wanted to break down, you know, the hierarchies as well.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty horizontal collective. And we're all from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different disciplines as well.
I noticed there hasn't been too much published on the website recently. Is there any publishing happening soon or?
Yes, there is. We have a lot of projects at the moment. We did take a couple of months over Christmas period just to chill out because we are all pretty burnt out. but we do. We've been doing, so for example, in a week we have a writing retreat for the PhD cohort at Monash. But then we're going to be part of Melbourne Fringe later this year, which we're super excited to be part of. And then we obviously have a different project that we've been doing, like scenes. And also normally every year we do a project that we call Spring Encounters, which brings activism and academia together in different local spaces.
Yeah. And so just I'm curious, actually, we had an interview with Dr. Kate Harridan from Monash about decolonizing our Western water systems. And you're familiar with her work. And she was sort of sharing with us that she sort of landed in this water space as a freshwater person and also as someone who grew up along the water and had a lot of strong opinions about stormwater. And that's sort of how she ended up in this space. How did you find yourself in water?
It's a very funny question because I sort of like landed in the space. I was doing a PhD about the underground at Monash, and obviously being a social scientist, it was pretty hard to do a PhD in the underground.
Yeah.
So the way that I was able to connect to the underground was through water.
Yeah.
Water has always been such an important element in my life since I was almost a baby. So it was really important for me to have a relationship with that resource.
Mm.
And also it's a resource that you can see across different, you know, vertical and horizontal dimensions.
Yeah. And Kate was also talking about how for local First Nations people, it's also a living thing.
Exactly.
And they have a relationship with the water. It's alive. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, it's the same, you know, like I had to be really connected to this element to, to have a relationship with it.
Which raises the question, really, should water have its own rights?
Such a contested question. yes, it's a trend now. Obviously, there's rivers around the world that have gotten personhood in legal systems, which also brings a lot of issues, you know, because then you can sue a river, but then what does that mean? And there's nobody really to advocate for the river unless there's like different, you know, here, for example, the Yarra has the Yarra Council, the Birrarung Council. And still, like, they don't have a lot of legal, you know, responsibilities. So it's just such a tricky space, water law.
So your current project, I believe it's current?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just want to get the right group. Can you remind me what the group you're working with? Monash and the Boonwurrung
Land and Sea Council.
Land and Sea Council, yes. So could you just give us a bit of an overview of what that project is and your role in it?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a research fellow in that project. It's an ARC linkage project.
Yep.
So it's government funded. And it's a project led by the woman Jeka Jembana Indigenous Research Lab at the Faculty of Art, Design and Architecture at Monash. And it's Indigenous led. So basically, it's called Repairing Memory in Place, an Indigenous led approach to water urban design. So we work alongside with two councils, which is Port Phillip City Council and Bayside City Council, Melbourne Water, Museums Victoria, and the land and Boomerang Land and Sea Council.
Yeah.
So the aim of the project is to develop tools for councils and water managers to understand or incorporate Indigenous knowledge of water into their, you know, policies and and management.
Yeah. And so there is, you know, there is obviously, actually, before we get to that question, how does your APR manifesto come into play? Because obviously this is something that you're trying to bring to your research as well. I'm just sort of curious, like, how are you bringing your own set of ethics and ethos sort of to this?
And I think that that has been pivotal in the work that I do now, also in the fellowship that I'll be doing at La Trobe, through my PhD working with Professor and senior elder Narwit Carolyn Briggs, who has been my friend, my mentor, my supervisor when I was doing my PhD, and my colleague in different projects. It was really important for me, and this is where APR also sits. It was really important for us to understand where we sit in terms of the system of relationality that it conforms NARM.
Yeah.
So it was important for me to understand what were the protocols that, like, what were going to be my protocols to engage with first knowledge people. And also, you know, as a foreigner, but also with Indigenous blood, I come from a very traditional town in Mexico.
Yeah.
So obviously I also come with a lot of cultural protocols of my own.
Yeah.
So APR, we celebrate diversity, we celebrate collectivity, and that's super important that we also acknowledge where we come from and we try to bring that into the spaces that we're working with, but also respecting the local laws, and that includes Indigenous knowledge.
Amazing. So sticking with Indigenous knowledge, obviously there is not only an Indigenous knowledge system that's been here for tens of thousands of years, but there's also been Indigenous legal systems. Elders often point out it's not just LAW law, but LORE law. So you're working with elders, which is a really encouraging thing to see in this space. How much community consultation is happening in this process?
So, okay, so here's the thing. As part of the project, we have very strict protocols, but also as part of like who I am, I don't believe that consultation is the best way to engage with first knowledge people.
Yeah, I believe
that they like projects should be led by by Indigenous stakeholders,
especially
when you're talking about Indigenous knowledge, because they know the knowledge, they know the law and the lore, as you said.
Yes.
So I don't believe in consultation that much.
Okay, yeah.
We've been using this project the other way around. So we're sort of consulting the stakeholders, the government stakeholders.
Oh, that's amazing.
So we're turning around the tables a little bit.
Yeah, I love that. That's great.
Yeah. So it's interesting because, this is a project that is Indigenous led. It's led by Dr. Brian Martin and Professor and, you know, Senior Elder Narwit Carolyn Briggs. So obviously, the way that we're thinking about things is completely different to this, you know, consultation aspect.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. And so maybe you could actually just give us a few examples of some of the things that are being brought forward that to the stakeholders that are like sort of what it is that they're asking of them. And also maybe what are the current problems with the water management system?
Oof.
Talk about. Yeah,
I'll give you a couple of examples.
To give you a bit of context, you know, this show is about challenging how we live in the cities and suburbs. Mm-hmm. And my research of our public water system, and thank God we have a nationalized public water system. Please do not privatize that. But it is flawed. And there is a water market that is flawed with the selling of water. Like the biggest example is... it's just escaped my brain. The river that crosses New South Wales and Victoria.
The Murray Darling.
Murray River Darling. Yes. I talked about it a couple episodes back. So we are living in a society that's built to meet this very big consumption, high consumption of resources without really understanding that the planet is finite and that there are other living species that depend on it and that we're all part of this same sort of ecosystem. So it's funny because a lot of people will talk about like the government campaign to put the onus of water saving onto its citizens, which to some extent there is actually a good point there. Like how much water is our showers using? But also like what big picture systems are in place that are actually leading to this masses of this precious resource being like consumed. So I just, that's sort of like the vibe of the show, I guess. And so if you could maybe like, if that helps you focus your answer.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's still pretty broad.
Well, okay. So the water sphere is really, really big, right? So for example, one of the things that we've been focusing in the project, but also in other projects that I'm part of, is in the idea of water literacy. So, you know, you learn in school where water comes from, but then we forget. And when you open the tap in your house, you sort of forget what the water, how you have access to that clean water.
Yeah.
So it's important to understand water in a very, like water is connected to the bigger environment. It's connected to the rain, it's connected to the evaporation of the bay, for example, here in Melbourne. It's connected through different dimensions of above and below, you know, spaces. So one of the aspects that we've been focusing, which we're really bringing to the attention of the stakeholders, is looking at water as an agent that is connected to a different kinds of agents in the environment.
Yeah.
And these agents, through this indigenous lens, we acknowledge that they have their own knowledge and agency.
Yeah.
So, for example, when we're thinking about stormwater, normally the traditional way of thinking of stormwater is either a nuisance. Normally it's pollution and how you can sort of take it away from the physical environment and then basically drain it and get it out of your view. Right.
It's also a space where there's a lot of misinformation as well, like just on stormwater as well. There's like in this urban planning space, I'm coming across a lot of conspiracy theories, and particularly in the RFK kind of vein of like, oh, people are getting vaccinated and then they're urinating and then the vaccines are getting into the water system kind of thing as well. So, yeah, I just wanted to comment on that. There's a lot of that happening in the media right now.
Yeah, or even geoengineered cyclones, apparently, which was another interesting theory, conspiracy theory.
Yeah,
but I guess the important thing is to recognize that water, especially in this area of the world that we're now, Melbourne used to be a swampland.
Yeah.
And water will return to places where water used to be.
Yes.
Especially because even though it's been highly modified, it's a highly modified environment, we still have, you know, areas where, you know, the water will come back to spaces. So, for example, old lagoons, swamps, lakes that existed that now have been filled in. Those are spaces where normally water will come back.
Yeah.
And obviously, understanding that, you know, through climate change and the different modifications of the land, rivers as well play a really important role. Yeah. So understanding how the expansion and retraction of these water bodies is really important for especially urban planning, no? And we've been seeing that with the floods since 2022.
Yes.
We're going to see it in the next 30 years because the new modeling from Melbourne Water is out.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people know that, but in 30 years, there's a lot of suburbs that will have an immense amount of flooding. And insurance comes into play.
Yeah.
And, you know, livelihoods comes into play. And who's going to respond for that?
Yeah. Well, that's probably a whole nother episode there for me to do there, actually. But just to give an example, I live near a suburb called Armstrong Creek in Geelong. And they, Barwon Water's doing some great work in building these sort of lakes and little creeks and stuff, basically reintroducing the endemic species. But the criticism people have in the urban planning space is not so, it's like, okay, great, thank you for taking pressure off stormwater and to help the water go somewhere. But the problem is, again, thinking in that atomized lens, the public water company, first of all, their first and foremost priority is to make sure the citizens get water, which sometimes supersedes the ecological.
Exactly.
But also, there's a different rules for the public sector and the private property sector. So in Armstrong Creek, there are floodplains where they are building houses on,
mm-hmm.
because it's a massive urban sprawl area of very unenvironmentally friendly housing. It's like you look on one side, there's this beautiful park where they're trying to be environmentally conscious, and then there's bugs, and then on the other side, there's no greenery, there's these massive houses, there's no stormwater tanks. Like, it's, it doesn't understand that bigger ecosystem connection. And I think, listeners, if you want to, there's a really good documentary on ABC called The Australian Wild Odyssey, which follows water and its movement all across the continent, and how we're connected to the water, our water systems here are connected to the water systems in the Northern Territory.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just, we can't think in this sort of atomized lens when it comes to these things.
Exactly. And this is where I'm trying to bring this sort of groundwater as well, because we completely forget that, you know, we have aquifers under our feet that are the most, one of the most important things in the world in terms of access to water and safe water. So we have to understand it in a more of a holistic sense, rather than just water as a mere resource that is there to serve human-centric needs.
Yeah.
Which is basically what architecture and urban planning, you know, does.
Mm. And so I've heard sort of Marxist urban planners who are very much into the sort of the right to the city type lens criticize urban planning as just another arm of neoliberalism. Are you as cynical or?
A little bit, yes. Yeah. But then again, urban planning is not my expertise. But yes, I do feel like even other tactics like greening and, you know, rewilding, which is becoming a thing as well in the last decade, I do feel like it's so human centric, and we forget that it's not only about humans. And this is where, again, recognizing the agency of water brings equity between water and humans. So there shouldn't be, you know, this aspect like, yeah, we need water to survive, but also, you know, if there's no water, we won't survive. We need to give water the same, you know, importance.
So what water source is the Boonwurrung project focusing on? Because obviously there's many rivers across the state. Which water sources are we talking about?
So we are focusing in two particular sites. However, we're looking at water in, like I said, in this holistic sense. So one of them is remembering the memories of water in Sandridge, the old Sandridge Lagoon, which is in Port Melbourne.
Yeah.
And that is one of the spaces that water has been completely raised.
Yeah.
But it does come back, you know, especially through rising water tables that is now happening.
Yeah.
And the residents are, you know, they're very aware of it. And this is one of the areas that in 30 years is going to be in debate. Like, sea level rise will be too high. And I don't know what they're going to do with Port Melbourne. So that's one area. The other area is in Bayside. And we're looking into groundwater through the existence of old indigenous rock wells.
Okay, yep.
Until today, I'm pretty sure we're not going to disclose where the rock wells are just because they're, you know, culturally significant. But we're thinking about, you know, the intricacies between groundwater and, you know, seasonality as well with water management.
Yep. We have six seasons down here, not four. People don't know that.
Yeah, exactly. Or even more.
You know? Yeah, it depends on which nation we're talking about. Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's important to recognize that water changes and morphs and it's so different.
Yeah.
So those are the areas to sort of mention.
Yeah, I know. That's really good. We're coming towards the end of the show. Think Again will be coming in soon. And I thought that was like really good. And I think maybe I'll get you back on again to talk more about these things at some point. So what advice do you have for, because even in my industry, which is gardening, there's a lot of people who want to do a job that is also earth care, that is also caring for people and wildlife. But it's very difficult because the overall neoliberal system, settler colonial system, is so driven by profit and maintaining the status quo that we often find that our so-called green jobs or our so-called spaces in academia end up being quite disappointing. So do you have any advice for people looking to go into sort of the academic field, how they can navigate this sort of these systems?
It's a very tough one because institutions don't have the flexibility to work through this like mindset. I personally felt that through my PhD, and I still feel it in this project. So there's two areas. Like, if you want to work with Indigenous people, you have to, especially in an institution, in academia, I feel like the universities sort of, and I hate this, but they're taking this tokenistic approach to having an elder in residence or, you know, like access to elders for their knowledge.
Yeah.
But they don't give them enough tools to have a proper space, which is incredibly disappointing. And also it's a lot on them because universities forget that these people have cultural responsibilities as well outside of the university.
Yeah.
So managing those lifestyles is really tough.
Yeah.
So I would say with somebody that wants to go into this field sphere, I would suggest you have to take the time and build a relationship.
Yeah, and maybe follow APR Collective?
Absolutely.
And where can we do that?
Well, you can follow us. We have a webpage called aprcollective.com.
Yep.
But we also have Instagram where we normally post everything that we do.
Yep.
So it's at APR Collective and also Twitter at APR Collective.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for listening. And we're going to go out with Redwoods by Hayley Hendricks. Thank you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.